Hi, a couple of takes today on that piece of theater known here in the U.S. as the State of the Union. You know, the annual speech that the president gives to set out his agenda for the coming year. That happened, as I speak, it happened last night. And we're going to hear from a much-traveled speechwriter on Obama's rhetoric and how it compares to, well, political rhetoric in other parts of the world. We're also going to hear on the speech that often gets overlooked, which is the opposition response. It didn't get overlooked this year, I think, because Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who is rumored to be interested in running for the presidency next time around, he delivered that response in both English and Spanish. He is Cuban-American. And the Republicans, of course, have a lot of catching up to do in the polls among Latinos. And this was, well, it was an awful lot about that. First, though, it's political consultant and speechwriter Tad Devine. He's worked here in the U.S. for Democrats like Al Gore and John Kerry. He's also worked as a consultant around the world, all over the world, in fact, in Europe, Latin America, Asia. He's worked in all those places. Now, on The Big Show, we wanted to quiz Devine on a graphic done by The Guardian newspaper's website. I'll post a link. That graphic tracks presidential speeches over the years according to their readability levels. And it concludes that the State of the Union has gotten progressively dumber. That's their word, not mine. In other words, you don't need particularly high reading skills to figure out what Obama was saying. And they're talking about passages in the speech like this.
Idea's parents, Nate and Cleo, are in this chamber tonight, along with more than 24 Americans whose lives have been torn apart by gun violence. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
But is that kind of rhetoric, just because it uses simpler and fewer words, is that dumber than the more flowery stuff in the past? That is what The Big Show's Marco Werman asked Tad Devine.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it that way. I think it's accurate to say that the language employed today is directed more towards a typical American audience than it was 200 years ago. I think the president and his team are utilizing the same techniques that President Bush, President Clinton, and others have, which is to conduct extensive research, polling, and other forms of research to try to settle on language and also policy proposals that move the target of the speech. The target in this case isn't just the people sitting in the room, the Congress, but also the broader electorate. And in order to do that, you need to speak in words and phrases that people relate to and understand. So, for example, when the president talks about the sequester, something that people in Washington like to talk about, he's going to get nowhere with voters. And he and his team understand that. So he took the time last night, for example, to define that word, but then to talk about its implications and what it means. So I think this, you know, what they would call dumbing down, I would call developing language that actually connects with people that you want to move by your speech.
So is simplified English then kind of a good thing or more of a necessary thing for politicians who want to reach across, you know, social strata?
I personally think it's a very good thing because it allows leaders to communicate with citizens in a language they understand and relate to. These speeches, like the State of the Union, are meant to be opportunities for leaders to communicate with the public. They're not policy programs and proposals per se. They're much more an agenda-setting episode. So I think to communicate in language that voters understand is much more powerful than using words and phrases and jargon in particular that they simply can't relate to.
You know, but I can hear, you know, the language mavens, the English mavens saying, hey, you want to race to the top. I mean, you're going to compromise language?
Well, I don't think the president treated the American citizens like two-year-olds last night. I think he spoke about policy proposals. He touched on a number of topics. But the question is, what kind of political rhetoric do we want to have? Do we want to use political rhetoric that is so driven by policy and jargon that it's difficult for people to understand? Or do we want to use rhetoric that people can relate to, can understand, and can therefore decide whether or not they want to support policies based on that understanding? So I don't think it's a question of dumbing things down. I think it's a question of developing language that people can understand so they can make judgments about whether or not they want to support policy proposals.
Now, you've advised leaders from around the world, from former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Is this simplification of language, of rhetoric, an international thing?
Well, it's different around the world. You know, in Europe, for example, I think the speeches tend to be much more driven by policy. And therefore, the speeches have language which is much more complicated than the kind of language the president would have used last night in the State of the Union. When you go to Latin America, where I've done a lot of work, those speeches tend to be driven by an effort to connect emotionally with people. So there tends to be different language there and different rhetoric. I think the big difference is that in systems, particularly parliamentary systems, the manifesto of a political party really means something, because there's a very good chance if they take over the government that that manifesto will be led into law. And therefore, the content of it is very specific and driven by policy. And I think there's also an appetite, frankly, particularly in Western Europe among voters, to look closely at policy proposals and to make decisions about voting based on those proposals. So it differs from place to place, although overall, I would think, particularly in the areas that I tend to work on in campaigns, which is the creation of television advertising, that the simpler we get the television ads, particularly the 30-second television ads, the better in terms of connecting with voters.
I mean, that's what advertising is all about. And I guess you probably would argue that State of the Union address is a form of advertising. So you need to be punchy. You need to be pithy.
I think so. I think the American public has become used to consuming this long format speech in a way that they can relate to bit by bit, proposal by proposal. And it's effective. For example, last night there was a focus group conducted by Stan Greenberg, who's someone I've worked with over the years, done a lot of work around the world with him, and Democracy Corps, which tested swing voters in Denver, Colorado. All of those people sat in. They watched the president's speech. They had dials in their hand, and they evaluated the speech second by second. And what the report of that focus group demonstrates, I think pretty conclusively, is that the president had an enormously effective speech last night with the most important block of voters, those people who are soft and persuadable. And he connected with them both in the language that he used and the way he delivered it. So, you know, these speeches are tested before they're given, while they're given, and the impact of it will be tested after it's given by the follow-up tracking polls. And I think what people are going to see is what we saw in the research last night when it was done live, that that was a very effective speech by the president that hit the target.
Ted, you spoke about the passion that politicians in Latin America kind of evoke when they're speechifying. Give us an example.
Well, I think, you know, when you go to an event, as I have in places like Colombia or Bolivia, and tens of thousands of people are huddled into a square, candidates and also the people attending those rallies and events really get transfixed on the speaker and also on what they are saying. They are very evocative, and the emotions run very high, and that leads speakers, I think, to use rhetoric, whether it's the issues that are involved in the campaign, the personalities of their opponents, the place that they're in and its history, that tends to be a lot more emotional, frankly, than what we typically see in a speech in the United States or in Europe. And there's also other symbolism that is part of the political communication. For example, I've made a lot of ads in Latin America, and it's not untypical to have a statue of the Virgin Mary, in the background when you're filming someone who's running for president of a country. That's not something we would typically see in the United States.
But no,
that's
we would not.
That we'd see all the time, in Latin America. So those are, I think, powerful, both the imagery that we see and the language that leaders tend to use.
Now, you advise politicians in Afghanistan as well, and we heard earlier in the program that Obama's language on Afghanistan was kind of like an inkblot test. In the U.S., it was welcomed. In Afghanistan, though, they were like, really? The war is over? So is that also a function of simplified language?
Well, I think, you know, my work in Afghanistan was for Ashraf Ghani, and it consisted of, you know, producing television ads for that campaign. What we tried to do in that effort in both, you know, Pashto and Dari, and as well as English, believe it or not, where we tried to communicate with people who lived outside the country but had an interest in it, was to present an agenda for a forward-looking candidate who could lead that country into the future and had a real agenda for the future. That was a more limited sphere. It was taking something that's never happened before, and I don't know if it will ever happen again, which is to create television advertising and deliver it to a country where, you know, not everybody has a television set. But we found by doing that that many people in villages were, you know, clustered around the one set that might be there. It's different. A different kind of experience. But I thought, you know, what we did, while it didn't lead to his victory, nevertheless was effective. We got a lot of attention and notoriety for it. And he certainly was someone who the Western press felt would have been a great candidate and a great president.
Political consultant Tad Devine, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you.
Okay, now on to the Republican response to Obama's speech, which last night came from Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He blasted the president as a big spender, supporter of big government. You've heard all of that stuff before. Nothing much new there. But what was new was that Rubio delivered his message in both English and Spanish.
Aumentando los impuestos no va a crear puestos de trabajo en el sector privado y no existe un aumento de impuestos realista que pueda reducir nuestra deuda por casi 4 trillones de dólares.
Okay, so you may say that it's a not very subtle Republican effort to reach out to Latino voters, who, after all, played a critical role in Obama's re-election last fall. Senator Rubio, as a Cuban-American, has got immigrant roots, and he talked about that in his speech. He's also one of the senators supporting comprehensive immigration reform, which looks like it's got a little bit of momentum right now. We wondered how Rubio's speech in Spanish might have gone down among American Latinos. Back again to Marco, talking with Richard Pineda. He's a politics and communications professor at the University of Texas at El Paso. And first off, Marco asked whether a Republican politician speaking in Spanish would make a difference.
Well, Marco, I think it's an important nod to the Latino community, as you indicated. And I think for people around the country, it certainly is important to hear a politician who has that particular immigrant background. I will say what's interesting is that a lot of markets didn't carry that immediately afterwards. And so, for example, I had to watch that online. So right out of the gate, there's some question about how much depth and where the speech was actually heard.
And why didn't everybody carry it?
I don't know, but I think that that's an important question just about the populations and where the dispersal of the Latino population is in the United States. I think it also begs the question about how significant media felt the speech was to address that particular population. And so in some ways, I would contend that even with the importance of the timing of that speech, that really what you're looking at is another level of window dressing in terms of reaching out to the Latino community.
Mm. Now, I don't speak Spanish, but I'm told that Marco Rubio speaks Spanish with a Cuban accent. His parents are Cuban, so that's understandable. But does that accent affect how Latinos elsewhere in the U.S., like Mexican Americans, for instance, how they hear his message?
I think that's a great question. There's two important answers to that. The first is yes. I think that Spanish, while certainly universal across the Latin American community, is heavily nuanced, and it's also heavily accented. And those accents really do have some impact on intergroup dynamics. And so, in other words, people who are Cuban have a distinct accent from quite a few folks that are Puerto Rican and folks that are from Mexico. So I think that there is some dissonance immediately in terms of the language. So I think that Spanish language listeners would know that Senator Rubio is Cuban, and that may come with a certain level of baggage.
What kind of baggage were you referring to?
There's a lot of nationalism that still exists. So if you speak to Mexican Americans, for example, who are in the second or third generation, they really distinguish themselves from Cuban Americans, who they see in a different and distinct light. I think that it reveals the subtlety of a class conflict that exists across the Latino community, and also I think highlights the geographic difference and disparity, so that you've got a very unique experience in terms of immigration for groups in different parts of the country.
So did Marco Rubio sway Latinos last night?
In some ways, the speech that I heard last night was a translation of the speech that was done in English. And so there's an interesting question about the intent and the actual construction of the speech. Mm. I think if the Republicans were really looking to use Rubio to the maximum potential, his response to the State of the Union would have been critical, of course, of the president as it was, but would also address some thought about policy change on issues like immigration or on policies that deal specifically with the Latino community. And so questions aimed particularly at education that were specific to that group. I think that the difficulty, and this is really the dance in some ways the Republicans will have to engage in over the next 2 years going into the midterms and then 4 years going into the presidential, is how to outreach to these communities without losing the base of their supporters. And even this morning, I mean, I read a statement from one of the more conservative English-only movements, and one of their spokespeople was talking about how they were very disappointed that this speech was given in Spanish, because they said that this continued to sort of coddle the immigrant who doesn't want to learn English. And so when you've got a party that's fighting over those issues, I think no matter how effective or how strong the message is, the policy message is in a speech like this, I think you lose it to the noise of all of these other participants who are fighting about the role of this community in the United States as a whole.
Professor Richard Pineda at the University of Texas, El Paso, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, that's it for this time. I'll see you on Facebook at the World in Words page. Also on Twitter, my nom de Twitter is Patrick Ox, PatriCox. Or you can visit theworld.org/language. Bye for now.